And you are indeed listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, emanating from the left coast of North America. Let me see, what else can I tell you? We're broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial. We are streaming 24/7 at freakradio.org. That's F-R-E-A-K, freakradio.org. Go to our main page, and follow the instructions on how to tune in to our streaming link. Costs nothing to you. Make sure your speakers are turned up. I am Ren Tawil, and this is the Mideast Migraines program for December the 22th, 2014.
والوقت زاد مستني وبان الوداع لما يا قلبي يا قلبي يا قلبي يا قلبي يا تفرحني لما يا قلبي يا قلبي يا قلبي لما يا قلبي يا قلبي يا قلبي يا قلبي يا
This is the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, your underground pirate, strictly grassroots community radio service, uncompliant with FCC regulations so as to keep us free from the icky octopugonal tentacles of corporate influence, and I think we do a pretty darn good job at that. All right, a pretty damn good job at that. I don't want to subtract attention from just how wonderful we are here. This is the Mideast Migraine Show for Monday, December 22nd, 2014 is the year. This is from Truth Dig, Drilling Beneath the Headlines. Another one of those quite obviously, hopelessly leftist, liberal internet news websites, Truth Dig. ISIS, the new Israel, written by none other than the hopelessly liberal leftist Chris Hedges. ISIS, the new Israel, posted December 15. Yeah. The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, or ISIS, is our Frankenstein. The United States, after a decade of war in Iraq, pieced together its body parts. We jolted it into life. We bathed it in blood and trauma. And we gave it its intelligence. Its dark and vicious heart of vengeance and war is our heart. It kills as we kill. It tortures as we torture. It carries out conquest as we carry out conquest. It is building a state driven by hatred for American occupation, a product of the death, horror, and destruction we visited on the Middle East. ISIS now controls an area the size of Texas. It is erasing the borders established by French and British colonial powers through the 1916 Sykes-Picot Agreement. There is little we can do to stop it. ISIS, ironically, is perhaps the only example of successful nation-building in the contemporary Middle East, despite the billions of dollars we have squandered on Iraq and Afghanistan. Its quest for an ethnically pure Sunni state mirrors the quest for a Jewish state eventually carved out of Palestine in 1948. Its tactics are much like those of the Jewish guerrillas who used violence, terrorism, foreign fighters, clandestine arms, shipments, and foreign money, along with horrific ethnic cleansing and the massacre of hundreds of Arab civilians to create Israel. Antagonistic ISIS and Israeli states, infected by religious fundamentalism, would be irreconcilable neighbors. This is a recipe for apocalyptic warfare. We provided the ingredients. I, Chris Hedges, and Loretta Napoleoni, the author of the book The Islamic Phoenix, spoke at a December 2 event in Manhattan at the headquarters of the New York Society for Ethical Culture. Napoleoni pointed out that the message imparted to Muslims by ISIS is radically different from that of other jihadist groups, especially Al-Qaeda. ISIS does not call for martyrdom and self-immolation. It has launched a jihad against secular and discredited regimes in the Middle East rather than against Western targets abroad. It is seeking to establish, as the Zionists did in Palestine, a utopian religious state. It holds up the ancient caliphate, which united Muslims throughout the Middle East in the 7th century, and whose time is considered the golden age of Islam, as an ideal. Much as Jews held up the biblical kingdoms chronicled in the Hebrew Bible, ISIS, to build its state, has called on engineers, doctors, and technicians to immigrate to the area it controls. And ISIS, although devoted to a fundamentalist form of Salafist Islam, is thoroughly modern. It has mastered sophisticated forms of electronic communication and delivers its messages through social media. And unlike groups such as Al-Qaeda, which bans television sets and radios, it views the technical advances of modern society as an asset. The mixture of fundamentalist religion with modernity is a potent and intoxicating brew for disenfranchised Muslims. And ISIS has attained what peaceful uprisings in the Middle East have not, liberation from detested regimes. At least for now. Quote, modern technology and a clear understanding of how our multipolar world functions, however, are not enough to succeed, Napoleoni writes of the uprisings known as the Arab Spring. Continuing with the quote here, is it possible that the smartphone uprisings, including the Arab Spring, failed where the Islamic State has succeeded because the latter, the Islamic State, is managed by a professional elite, which guides the rank and file, while the former finds itself at the mercy of their constant interaction and participation? If so, is the Islamic State's model of nation building more modern than that of the Arab Spring? End quote. Terror, as was true for the Jewish fighters in Palestine in the late 1940s, is an effective tool to intimidate opponents and accelerate ethnic cleansing. The fear of ISIS in its most potent weapon. Iraqi army troops, although better armed than ISIS fighters and outnumbering them, drop their U.S.-supplied weapons and flee before ISIS. Shiites abandon whole villages to ISIS, and all the U.S. advisors sent to put some spine in the Iraqi government forces have so far been unable to significantly stem the advance. Sunni militants in Iraq consciously orchestrated the conflict between Sunnis and Shiites. This clash, as was true in the former Yugoslavia, is not the result of ancient ethnic hatreds. It was created for a political expediency When Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the Jordanian radical, arrived in Iraq, he founded al-Tahid al-Jihad. His group used forged documents to infiltrate over 100 fighters from al-Qaeda, most of whom had been in Afghanistan, into Iraq. Zarqawi's goal was to spark, under the cover of fighting the Western coalition forces, a sectarian conflict with the Shiites. He understood that a unified Shiite and Sunni state would thwart the dream of a Sunni Islamic state. He had to ignite a religious war. His group in 2004 eventually became al-Qaeda in Iraq and declared its loyalty to Osama bin Laden, who had initially rejected Zarqawi's tactic of attacking Shiites. Zarqawi was killed in 2006. His death was followed a year later by the so-called Sunni Awakening. By 2010, the radical group was almost extinct. I'm reading from an article from Truthdig, entitled ISIS, the New Israel, written by Chris Hedges. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who claims to be a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, and who holds a degree in Islamic studies from the University of Baghdad, was held in 2004 by U.S. forces in southern Iraq's Camp Buka, where he built a following among his fellow prisoners. He took over the leadership of Zarqawi's organization, changed the name of the group to the Islamic State of Iraq, and moved its members to Syria to fight in the civil war there. Once there, he amassed weapons and cash pouring into Syria from countries such as Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Qatar. He used these resources to rebuild his group, not to help the rebels overthrow the Syrian regime. He began attacking other jihadist and rebel groups and carved out territory under his exclusive control. Al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda-affiliated group in Syria, merged with the Islamic State of Iraq. The new group became the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS. ISIS has now seized control of enough resources to be self-sufficient. The group is estimated by the Wall Street Journal to earn $2 million a day in oil exports alone. And it has attracted an estimated 12,000 foreign fighters, including 2,000 from Europe. In June 2014, it declared the establishment of a new caliphate. The historical caliphate, which lasted from the Prophet Muhammad's death in 632 to 661, controlled a vast empire that stretched from the Arabian Peninsula and the Levant across North Africa and up to Central Asia. And religious militants have long held it up as the ideal for the Muslim state they seek to create. By 2011, Baghdadi had been designated by the U.S. State Department as a, quote, specially designated global terrorist, end quote. The United States has posted a reward of up to $10 million for information leading to his capture or death. Technically speaking, the caliphate is the religious and political authority that is above everybody else, Napoleoni said earlier this month before the Society for Ethical Culture. She continued, every single Muslim government is automatically below the caliph. This is a huge threat to countries like Saudi Arabia. ISIS is a mortal threat to the House of Saud. It is an open challenge to the religious authority of the Saudi ruling family, which is the custodian of Mecca, the site of the holiest shrine in Islam. It challenges by anointing Baghdadi as caliph, the right of the Saudis to determine religious doctrine. As Baghdadi, in the eyes of many Muslims, has the aura that surrounded partisan leaders such as the Yugoslav Josip Broz Tito during World War II. Foreign recruits crossing over the border from Turkey into Syria will often fall to their knees, weep, and pray before entering ISIS's new caliphate. The danger, Napoleoni pointed out, is not that ISIS will invade Saudi Arabia, but that it will delegitimize the Saudi monarchy. This, she said, could trigger an upheaval inside the kingdom and threaten the viability of one of Washington's most important allies in the Middle East. The group is seen as an anti-imperialist force because it is erasing the borders within the old Middle East drawn after World War I by European cartographers, and because it defies the client states that are allied with Washington, or, in the case of Syria, with Russia and the Shiite government in Tehran. Tehran being the capital of Iran. Tribal communities cut in half in the wake of World War I are being reunited. At the same time, ISIS is restoring a semblance of law and order, although the harsh Islamic law it imposes is unforgiving to those deemed to be apostates, including the Shiites. Quote, they are very sensitive to the needs of the population, Napoleoni said of ISIS. The population, she points out, has, quote, been plagued by war for a very long time. They have been plagued by warlords, by criminal groups, by jihadi groups, you name it. All of a sudden, the Islamic State comes in and works so that people can have access to basic infrastructure such as water or electricity. They set up joint ventures with the local people in order to give the local people the opportunity to grow economically and also to go back to the normality of life. And also to go back to the normality of life, end quote. Napoleoni speaking there. This brutal order has ended the chaos that has dominated much of the region following the U.S. occupation of Iraq. I'll read that again because I think it's important to keep in mind. This brutal order of this new caliphate has ended the chaos that has dominated much of the region following the U.S. occupation of Iraq. It has instilled in Sunnis pride and even a feeling of omnipotence, and it has exposed as weak and ineffectual the corrupt forces that Washington put into place to administer Iraq. Quote, they are protecting the people from the internal criminal organizations, warlords, Napoleoni went on. She continues, they are protecting the borders from the outside enemies. I call it the shell state because, of course, these people don't have the right of self-determination. They seek their consensus inside in order to achieve the kind of political identity that will transform a state shell into a real state. I think this is absolutely outstanding for an armed organization because, you know, at the end of the day, these guys are terrorists, end quote. You are listening to the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Lawrence Wren Tawil. For Monday, December 22nd, the 3 o'clock Monday afternoon edition of Mideast Migraines. The other edition comes to you every Saturday at 11 a.m. and features the fairly newly begun group. We're now, I believe, in the midst of newly begun book entitled Freedom Sailors. We're now in Chapter 5, I think it is. to catch up on your readings of Freedom Sailors up to this point, go to radioforall.net. That's R-E-D-I-O, the numerical character for A-L-L.net, radioforall.net. Mideast Migraines programs are archived there. I'm going to play for you now, hopefully with some success, the video that Hedges referred to in the article I just read. Again, he said, I, Hedges, and Loretta Napoleoni, the author of the book The Islamic Phoenix, spoke at a December 2 event in Manhattan at the headquarters of the New York Society for Ethical Culture. Here is that soundtrack. A progressive voice created by Leah Cohen.
We'll have, if you'd like to start, and then I'll introduce Chris afterwards.
Okay, so, well, thank you for being here. So I'm going to talk for 6 minutes, right, about the Islamic State. So let's start with what do we know about it? Not very much. The media has projected primarily its barbarous side. So, you know, we all know about the beheading. We all know about the ethnic cleansing and religious cleansing that is taking place in the territories that Islamic State has conquered and is controlling. We also know that it is potentially an agent of destabilization inside the Middle East and possibly even a threat to us in the West. So this is all that we know. What we do not know, and this is what I try to present in the book, The Islamic Phoenix, is another side of the Islamic State. Number one, this is the first armed organization that has succeeded in the transition into a state. So it has created a state, which is quite big. So we're talking about a territory that can be as big as France or Texas. This is the first time that something like this happened. It's also an organization that is running the state with a certain sensitivity to the needs of the population. In that, it's very modern because it has realized that you can't possibly run a state today simply by oppressing people. You need to achieve consensus. Now, this is a major step forward in the way armed organization act. The PLO, for example, when it was in the occupied territories in Palestine, was not showing the same kind of approach to the consensus among the population. So, because of that, the way the state is run is also very pragmatic. So they enter agreements and joint venture for the exploitation of the resources that they have conquered with the local population through the tribal leaders, which of course makes them appear to the people.
Excuse me, Loretta, sorry to interrupt, but people are in the audience are saying they're having trouble hearing. Is it not loud enough, or? If you could speak closer to the microphone.
More like this.
Yeah? Is that okay? Okay? It's very close. All right. So the element of consensus is fundamental. So this is a much more serious.
Today is Monday, December 22nd.
We are led to believe. Let's look, for example, at another interesting aspect is the message that the Islamic State is sending to us and to the Muslim population that shows a very in-depth knowledge of the psychology, the different psychology between Western and Muslim. While they terrorize us through this beheading and also these images of barbarous behavior, they send to the Muslim youth a very seductive message. And this
is Free Radio Santa Cruz. You are listening to the Mideast Migraines program for Monday, December 22nd. You are listening also to a talk given by Chris Hedges and Loretta Napoleoni on the Islamic State and the crisis in U.S. It is 3:31 p.m. Pacific time.
Seductive message is a positive message. In the old days, al-Zarqawi and al-Qaeda were sending a negative message. Come, you know, become suicide bombers and live happily for the eternity with the 72 virgins. This time it's not like that at all. The message is come and help us build a new state, your state, the first Sunni state. So the first time that the message is, for the first time, that political utopia, the Sunni political utopia, which has been there for centuries, to recreate a caliphate, to create a state that will protect every single Muslim, is actually taking shape. And the message is, come and help us. You're an engineer, so you can come and help us running, you know, the dams, the water dams. You are a doctor, you can come and help us, you know, vaccinating children against polio. So this is a very, very seductive message, but also it's a very modern message, very different from Al-Qaeda, where, you know, of course, even using radio or TV was prohibited. These guys use two weapons. You know, one is the true weapon, which is, of course, a military weapon, but the other one is the iPhone. So through that, they also use modern technology, and they reach us everywhere. So just to conclude my 6 minutes, the other interesting aspect of this state is the manipulation of the media that they have achieved. We heard from them when they wanted them to be known, which is in June 2014, but they've been there since 2011, and we'll talk about that, about the origins. And the moment in which they wanted us to know their existence, and they wanted us also to know how powerful they are, you know, they did it. And the Western media and even the politicians, unfortunately, I think they fell into that trap. So we need to understand which kind of enemy we're facing. Otherwise, you know, we're going to lose this battle as we have lost the previous one. Thanks.
Thank you, Loretta. And that's really rare to find a speaker who sticks to the 6 minute time limit. So congratulations for that. Okay, let's see if we can go two for two. A senior fellow at the Nation Institute and a columnist for Truth Dig, Chris Hedges spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, with 15 years at the New York Times. He is the author, among others, of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and Death of the Liberal Class. I'm sorry. His most recent book with Joe Sacco is Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, a New York Times bestseller and Amazon.com best book of the year. Chris Hedges.
Thanks. I will just also say that I spent seven of those years in the Middle East. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. I'm an Arabic speaker. And I spent a lot of my times with groups that are listed on the State Department terrorism list, from the PKK to Hamas to Islamic Jihad to Al-Qaeda. What we are seeing in the Middle East is a creation of our own mismanagement and the doctrine of preemptive war, which under post-Nuremberg laws is a war crime. an act of aggression. We, through the process of endless war, and this is what happens when you open that Pandora's box of violence, you essentially lose control of the narrative that you're trying to impose by force. And that, I think, has become evident in the current situation in Iraq and Syria, where we now find ourselves functioning, especially in Syria, as the air force for Bashar al-Assad, Hezbollah, and Iran, all of which are fighting rebel forces in Syria. We have taken sides in the civil war that we fomented in Iraq, and the chief result of the occupation in Iraq is that we have destroyed Iraq as a unified country. It's never coming back. It's been partitioned in the north with the Kurds and between the Sunnis and the Shiites. We have, in many ways, completely changed sides because of the kind of shifting sands of violence that have taken place throughout the region. When you carry out, and it's difficult if you have not been on the receiving end of the industrial weapons that we employ, the cruise missiles, the 90-millimeter tank rounds, 155 howitzers, attacks from Apache helicopters, F-16s. It's hard to describe the explosive or the lethal power of these kinds of ordnances. Hellfire missiles, for example, not only kill within a very wide radius, but suck the oxygen out of the air so that you'll find bodies on the ground that have no mark on them, but they've suffocated to death. And to sort of use the whole notion of surgical strikes or human rights when you employ these kinds of weapons is an absurdity. And we have been, for over a decade, dropping these kinds of ordnances indiscriminately throughout the region. And the result has been a horrific brutalization of the population. The fact is, as a nation, we have beheaded far more people, including children, than ISIS has ever beheaded. And yet, the narrative that is presented to us as a public is so sanitized that we have no cognizance of, number one, what we've done or how we are perceived. The only thing we see is the result, that final, after that long, slow drip of humiliation, of suffering, of death, of inchoate rage, that final spasm of violence that expresses itself in an act of barbarity such as the beheading of a hostage. But the fact is, there is no moral difference between a militarized drone strike and cutting somebody's head off with a knife. We use the weapons that we have, and they use the weapons that they have. And I think one of the reasons that Loretta's book is important is because she's right. And I spent a year of my life covering Al-Qaeda for the New York Times. And in that, this group has characteristics within it that we have not seen in other groups, not least of which is the heavy infusion of foreign fighters. Al-Qaeda had very few. It was a clan-based organization. That's why it was very hard for Western intelligence agencies to penetrate, but they were also a lot easier to control. We now have several hundred people who are carrying EU, Canadian, Australian, and even U.S. passports. And they have quite astutely done, and I was telling Loretta this before, very much what Tito's partisans did at the end of World War II, where they realized that it was the competing jihadist groups around them who were their greatest threat to power. They took, as Tito did, Western weapons supplies that were supposed to be used against the Germans, used them against those competing groups, and stockpiled them so that they could essentially take over Yugoslavia or carve out territory. And that's very much what al-Baghdadi has done quite successfully, and makes this even, although it has antecedents in al-Qaeda itself, makes it a very different organization from al-Qaeda that didn't seek to maintain territory. And there was always that split between al-Qaeda and nationalist groups like the Gamma Islamiyah in Algeria, because they were essentially nationalist groups that were trying to create Islamic states. And I would just close by saying that Loretta is also very right, and Karen Armstrong makes this point when she writes about fundamentalism in the name of God, that while these people go back to a particular mythical, utopian vision of the past, they are thoroughly modern organizations, including in terms of their own religious ideology, although they paint it with a veneer of, a kind of authentic, old world kind of religion. Christian Wright, I wrote a book on the Christian Wright, does exactly the same thing. I think Loretta would agree with me that one of the things that's distressing is how we have allowed this group to essentially become a cartoon version of Islamic terror, which fits with a narrative and a dehumanization of Muslims without ever understanding our own role in its creation or how this group has made a really massive leap in terms of what it's able to do and how it's formed and how different it is from groups that have come before.
Thank you, Chris. So I'm going to throw out a few questions and get the discussion rolling. And remember to write down your questions if you have any. So this question's for Loretta, but Chris, certainly I would like to hear from you on this too. There's a lot of confusion, even among pretty well-informed Americans, about the military, financial, and political origins of the group, variously known as ISIS, the Islamic State, or ISIL, as the Obama administration calls it. So what is the relationship with al-Qaeda, the al-Nusra Front? Where did ISIS originate? Where did they come from? If we could just sort of get the ISIS 101.
ISIS 101. Well, this is a group that goes back to the group of al-Zarqawi. So we're talking about radical Salafism. The original name was...
Why don't you explain what a Salafist?
Yes. The Salafists is actually a movement within Islam that originally was actually quite liberal. It looked at the West as a sort of example of nation state. So we're talking about the beginning of 19th century. So, then it degenerated to a certain extent because of colonization, and it started to look at the West as actually the enemy. While before it was a self-criticism of why the Arab world had not achieved the same thing that Europe had achieved, so, a nation state, because of colonization, it became an anti-European, anti-Western movement. Radical Salafism actually took place in the beginning of the 1990s in Jordan when the Jordanian government recognized the existence of Israel. At that point, the reaction of a group of Salafists was to reject completely the doctrine and go back to the origins of Islam. So go back to what Islam was at the beginning of the history. So a sort of cleansing of Islam from any kind of influence through the centuries. So through this process, they rediscover the hatred between the Sunni and the Shia. So one of the most important goal of radical Salafism is actually to, I wouldn't say to kill, but basically to get rid, that's a better expression, to get rid of the Shia. So when al-Zarqawi arrived in Iraq, he started his group, which was called Tawhid al-Jihad. And one of the objectives of this group was not only to fight the coalition forces in Iraq, but was also to fight the Shia. So this is when the fight between the Sunni and the Shia actually started. Now that group eventually became al-Qaeda in Iraq, and this was when Osama bin Laden recognized al-Zarqawi as the emir of al-Qaeda in Iraq. But the group was never really an al-Qaeda group. So with the death of al-Zarqawi in 2006 and the Sunni awakening, which took place in 2007, together with the U.S. surge, all the jihadist groups started to have serious troubles, and they declined. And in particular, of course, this took place for, you know, the al-Qaeda in Iraq and the group that was following, you know, the al-Zarqawi doctrine, let's call it like that. In 2010, al-Baghdadi became the leader of what was left of the original group of al-Qaeda in Iraq, and he immediately changed the name to the Islamic State of Iraq. Now, at that point, that group was on the verge of extinction, so the decision was taken to move over to Syria, where in the meantime, a war by proxy had started because of the civil war which had taken place after the repression, the violent repression of the Arab Spring in Syria by the Assad government. So the decision was, you know, to move over and tap into the war by proxy, which was funded by various countries. In particular, we're talking about Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Qatar, and use those money to reconstitute the group and eventually achieve the goal of the group, which is still the same of the al-Zarqawi group, which was, of course, to recreate the caliphate. So they move over to Syria, and from 2011 until the end of 2012, beginning of 2013, they use the money of the sponsor not to fight a war by proxy, but actually to attack other jihadist groups and conquer the strategic territories in order to start carving their own little enclaves, which eventually, you know, became a state. They were so successful that many people decided to, from other jihadist groups, decided to join them. And this is when the merge with al-Nusra took place. Al-Nusra was the al-Qaeda group in Syria, or at least, you know, the affiliated, you know, group in Syria. The merge transformed the Islamic State of Iraq into the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, which is, you know, ISIS. Al-Sham is the word, the Arabic word for Syria. Now, that merge was heavily criticized by al-Qaeda, in particular by al-Zawahiri, who, of course, you know, didn't want the presence of al-Baghdadi and his group in Syria. He wanted them to go back, you know, to Iraq. Now, al-Baghdadi answered in the same way the al-Zarqawi had 10 years before, when he was equally criticized for his action in Iraq, by saying, you know, I follow the word of God, I'm not following the word of al-Zawahiri. So from that merge onwards, the Islamic, what's now known the Islamic State, managed to conquer larger and larger territories by self-funding itself. So it stopped needing the money of the sponsor because he had conquered enough strategic resources. And we're not only talking about oil, but we're talking about water, and we're talking about, you know, agricultural land, very rich agricultural land. So he established itself as a new power in the region. And this took place through 2013 and basically until June 2014. Of course, we didn't know that. This is very interesting that intelligence didn't know, the media didn't know. And this is why before I said we knew only when they wanted us to know, when they were ready to establish themselves as a new important power in the region when they declare the birth of the caliphate, which is the end of June 2014.
I think this would be a good question for Chris.
Let me just add something quickly on that to highlight that which Loretta alluded to, but there were tremendous conflicts between Al-Qaeda.
Huge.
As there is throughout the region. For instance, Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden never embraced the Shiite Sunni sectarian violence, for instance. No. And one of the things that's frustrating for those of us who come out of the region is the way that all of these groups, in the way that, you know, you kind of blanket it in the old Cold War, all communists, as if Yugoslav communists were the same as, you know, Czech communists. And in fact, these groups, these Islamic groups, if you want to call them militant groups, have tremendously deep divisions. You cannot go wading into the region until you begin to understand what those divisions are. For instance, Al-Qaeda has declared that Hamas as apostates because they negotiate with the Israelis through Egyptian security officials. What happened, just to amplify what Loretta said, what happened in Syria is very similar to what happened with the Taliban during the fight against the Russians in Afghanistan. All of the money that the United States provided was funneled through the ISI, or the Pakistani Intelligence Service, and for Pakistan, the issue was always India. They don't really care. They had to make sure that whatever government was implanted in Kabul would be hostile to their enemy, India. So therefore, the Taliban were the safest bet. And they used that money to essentially starve all of the other resistance groups. And once you start sending that quantity of money and that quantity of weapons, as we have in Syria, you don't know where it goes. You lose control. And so the irony of what's happened with ISIS is that not only have we, through primarily our allies like the Saudis and the Qataris, funded them, but we've armed them completely.
Yeah, definitely.
One of the defining characteristics of most radical Islamist groups is the dream of restoring the caliphate. And so this is a two-parter, and either of you guys should address it. First, if you could explain exactly what the caliphate is and the dream of, and why that's so important to Muslim fundamentalist groups and why they want to restore it. So many of them do, like Al-Qaeda. But also, to what extent is the Islamic State's declaration by al-Baghdadi that that ISIS represents the new caliphate accepted as legitimate by other Islamist organizations around the Muslim world?
Would you want
Chris, you go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the caliphate is a utopian vision. They don't really want to go back to the caliphate. But it is painted as a kind of return to paradise, return to simplicity, return to goodness, return to virtue. And given the incredible corruption that has beset every regime in the Middle East, and even those groups that opposed the status quo, like the PLO. This is a very seductive appeal. And that appeal is particularly effective among groups of Arab or Muslim youth who have essentially been stripped of their identity. So they've been born in Algeria or Tunisia or Morocco or somewhere, and they go live at the age of four, they're moved to France, and they live in a Banlieue, one of these horrible Stalinist-like suburbs outside of Paris or Lyon somewhere. And, you know, as anyone who can tell you who's lived in France, the French are awful to people of color, especially Arabs. And so they experience that kind of racism in France, but then they go back to Algeria, to Oran, or wherever they're from, and they don't fit in Algeria either. And they have this kind of identity crisis. I mean, when I covered Al-Qaeda, this was the classic profile. And so they're alienated, they're angry, they're unemployed, they don't know who they are, they're not French, they're not Algerian, what are they? And this kind of a vision is very enticing. And it being enveloped in this kind of a community is very enticing. And one of the points that Loretta makes in her book, which I think is important, is that the fighters themselves are not well paid. Yeah. They make, what, $17 a month or something, right?
Yeah, much less than a normal blue collar.
This isn't about money. Mm-hmm. It is, and that, of course, we can go back to other partisan or insurgent movements, and take Tito's Yugoslavia, was very much the same thing. You know, we are going to build a socialist state, we're going to overthrow the corrupt monarchy. You know, we had it in the West in terms of the Spanish Civil War, and I think that analogy is not far-fetched, that for many in the Muslim world, this is their chance to reclaim their identity, to deal with their alienation, to take revenge against those forces that have degraded them, and to build something utopian and beautiful.
Yeah. There is the other element to add. It is the political element, of course, of the caliphate. Because, I mean, technically speaking, the caliph is the religious and political authority that is above everybody else. So every single Muslim government is automatically below the level of the caliph. And that, of course, is a huge threat to countries like Saudi Arabia, because, you know, the House of Saud has been projecting the image to be the monarchy that has the right to lead all the Sunni Muslim in the world, not only because, of course, it's in Saudi Arabia where, you know, there is, you know, Mecca, but also because of its role in leading the doctrine and, you know, the people. The moment in which al-Baghdadi becomes the caliph, the House of Saud is not any longer in that position. Now, that is the real threat. This is the potential threat. Not necessarily in terms of the Islamic State wanting to invade Saudi Arabia, but the Islamic State's simple existence per se is a threat to the existence, the political power and religious power of the House of Saud. Now, what I think the Saudis are scared of, a sort of upheaval from inside Saudi Arabia because of the existence of the Islamic State, the will of the people who are not very happy inside Saudi Arabia, where, of course, you know, we have a royal family that is, you know, incredibly wealthy, and the rest of the population, which is kept under control through money, but not through, you know, ideals. I think, you know, they are afraid that this kind of appeal will shake completely the regime of Saudi Arabia. And then people will want to join, naturally, the Islamic State, forming a sort of federation, as it was originally the caliphate. Because the caliphate was not really a pyramidal kind of empire, but it was a much more loose kind of organization. And I also think that this is one of the reasons why the U.S. foreign policy has changed. So, you know, until August, until almost the end of August of this year, you know, Obama declared that he didn't have a policy vis-a-vis the Islamic State. So, in other words, you know, let them sort themselves out. You know, the U.S. does not have a position. And then all of a sudden, within a week, not only did we have a policy, but also we were leading a grand coalition of 44 countries, whereby, you know, Saudi Arabia had offered to train more troops, so, you know, just to enlarge the war by proxy, which has caused this kind of problem. And I think it was and still is, to protect Saudi Arabia, which, of course, you know, is one of the reasons why the Islamic State exists. So it's almost ironic.
Yeah, I think the Saudi regime is very fragile.
Yeah, totally.
And that's not, we see it with the number of troops the Saudis have moved up along the border.
Yeah.
Because they're terrified. And I think that's right, that the Saudi regime collapses from within, and that this kind of a movement has tremendous appeal.
Yes.
Among the majorities of Saudis who are quite sick of this parasitic, you know, royal family, which produces endless numbers of princes who consume large amounts of the GDP and do nothing.
Sorry that there was a misunderstanding about the cards. Just hang on to your cards and your questions. Someone will come around and collect them. So there's no need to walk up and give them to me. And those of you who have, they will be gone through. So one last question before we see the film, which will be, I'm looking forward to. And I would like definitely to hear from both Chris and Loretta on this. Loretta, you argue in your book that the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria represents a new kind of entity, a new kind of nation state and I wanted to hear how does ISIS differ from the Taliban regime that ruled Afghanistan from 1996 to 2001? They, at its peak, the Taliban controlled 95% of Afghanistan. It had embassies in three foreign countries. It conducted diplomatic negotiations with, among other countries, the United States, and over a pipeline project. What's the difference? How does it represent a sort of a higher notion or a different notion of a nation state than the Taliban did in Afghanistan?
Well, I think the Islamic State has succeeded in nation building in a region where we have tried many times and fail in nation building. There are many differences. For a start, the way this state has been carved is through a traditional war of conquest. I mean, the Taliban didn't do anything like that. They were put there by the Pakistani, as you know, Chris has very well, you know, explained. The war of conquest has been a classic one, so it's almost door-to-door through trenches. And this is also incredibly appealing to the young people that join. It's almost patriotic, the way they went about. It is in a region which was colonized, where the borders were drawn by foreign powers. In particular, we're talking about, you know, the UK and France. So the destruction of those borders was perceived as a sort of liberation for the people that were living in those regions. The message I know that many people will be shocked by what I'm saying, but the message that the Islamic State is transmitting to its followers is actually an anti-imperialist message. I mean, the Taliban were never anti-imperialist. They didn't even know what, you know, imperialism meant. So in that, I think they are modern in a way, but at the same time, you know, they're also, you know, very appealing to old traditions. Some of the tribes, after, you know, the knocking down of those borders, some of the tribes said, you know, finally, you know, we are reunited. I mean, these are nomad tribes, so I mean, we're not talking about nationalism the way the Europeans understand nationalism, or, you know, even the Americans, but we're talking about, you know, same kind of ethnic groups. So we're talking about ethnicity, and they were very clever. I think they were very clever to start from Syria to Iraq. I mean, this is a region that is quite homogeneous. So a majority Sunnis, not many. Different kind of ethnicity, but also different kind of religion. They're also pursuing a sort of ethnic cleansing and religious cleansing in order to create a state that is very, very homogeneous. Because it's easier to run a state that is very homogeneous, especially at the beginning. And then there is all the other side, which is the sort of social side of the Islamic State, when didn't exist with the Taliban, of course. The fact that they are very sensitive to the need of the population. So these are population that have been plagued by war for a very long time. They have been plagued by warlords, criminal groups, jihadist groups, you know, you name it. So all of a sudden, you know, the Islamic State comes in and works so that people can have access to basic infrastructure such as water or electricity. They set up joint ventures with the local people in order to give the local people the opportunity to grow economically. So that sensitivity also to an improvement in the everyday life, and also to go back to the normality of life, is something that, you know, the Taliban never, you know, consider. In that, this is a modern state. Because if you think about, you know, what are the two most important tasks of the state within, you know, the concept of the nation state, the European concept and American concept of the nation state, is guaranteeing law and order and guaranteeing national security. These are the first two things, and this is exactly what they're doing. They're protecting the people from the internal criminal organizational warlords. They are protecting the borders from, you know, the outside enemies. And within this kind of state, which I call it the shell state, because of course these people don't have, you know, the right of self-determination, they seek the consensus inside in order to achieve the kind of identity, political identity, that will transform a state shell into a real state. I mean, I think this is absolutely, you know, outstanding for an armed organization. Because, you know, at the end of the day, these guys, you know, are terrorists. That's what they are.
Well, you know, so was the Ergun. I mean, I think oftentimes, you know, when you don't have access to the kind of modern weaponry. This was true in the Algerian Civil War. You resort to what the state defines as terrorism as a way to fight back. I think one of the things that's important is to understand, and you touched on it, and this has a kind of continuity from Osama bin Laden right on through, and that's Sykes-Picot, the 1916 agreement, where the colonial powers at the end of World War I just carved up the Middle East into private little spheres of influence.
Yeah.
And if you go back and listen to Osama bin Laden, he's constantly talking about Sykes-Picot, as is ISIS. And the jubilation at the destruction of those borders is not only for ISIS but throughout the region, a jubilation at the destruction of colonial control, because these were in essence proxy states. And you know, we can't forget that our meddling throughout the Middle East, I mean, Iran, for instance, had a functioning democracy until we destroyed it.
Yeah.
And the same was true in Lebanon. And what we wanted were client regimes that did our bidding. And so the breaking down of these borders has not only historical resonance in terms of the injustices and tribes that were cut in half and linguistic groups that were cut, like the Kurds between Turkey and Syria and Iraq, but also a sense of liberation.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just will close quickly by saying that although the atrocities that have been committed by ISIS are well known because of social media, in every conflict that I've covered, atrocities like that have been part of it. Certainly that was true in Bosnia. I mean, every time we went into a new town in Bosnia, the warlords had dreamt up some new way to present a corpse, including, I remember going into a town and finding all these poor Muslims literally crucified on the side of a barn. So you don't see it because those kinds of atrocities were oftentimes too horrific for us to put out within the mainstream press. And the warlords, the Serbian warlords in Bosnia, were not putting it out themselves. So we're seeing it, but it doesn't mean there's more. It means that in every insurgency or conflict, and I covered the war in El Salvador in the early 80s, and when I got there, the death squads were killing between 700 and 1,000 people a month. And this was even beyond beheadings. You know, I mean, horrific mutilations. So that is, and the reason that insurgent groups use that, or in the case of the Salvadoran military, which was losing the war, is that terror becomes a very effective weapon, especially if you don't have an air force. So why does the Iraqi army run away when there's 10,000 of them and 2,000 of ISIS? It is because precisely of that image of terror that they seek to disseminate to, although far better equipped, armed forces that have no real will to fight, and that becomes a very effective way to defeat forces, as they have. Okay. They've done it with the Peshmerga, and they've done it, the Kurdish Peshmerga, and they've done it with the Iraqi National Army as well.
Yeah.
Okay, it sounds as if the duo of speakers has ended. I just got to figure out which screen I'm on here. That was Chris Hedges and both authors, Chris Hedges, Loretta Napoleoni, on the topic of the Islamic State and the crisis in the U.S. And that was for a talk they gave on December 2nd in Manhattan at the headquarters of the New York Society for Ethical Culture. Short musical break while I tend to some other duties. Thank you.
Antoinette Cleopatra, Al-Mutriba Hanan.
The numbers we have been listening to from this wonderful album, the album being The Music of Arab Americans, a retrospective collection, Rounder Records, 1997. Actually, this current piece is entitled in Arabic, Waqif ala Shat Bahar. Actually, there are translations in here. I just gotta Waqif ala Shat Bahar, standing on the shore. Before that was Raqs Arabi, or Arabic dance, and I believe we began the show with Lama Ya Albi, When, O My Heart of Mine, When, O Heart of Mine, Lama Ya Albi. This is my best album, my favorite album of Arabic music in my non-vast collection. Okay, see, it's 4:24 in the afternoon. Now it's 4:25. This Monday, December 22nd, 2014, you are listening to the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren. Got a three-ring phone call a few minutes ago. They hung up by the time I got around to picking up. Let me give you that number for the rest of you who feel like hanging on until I do pick up and we can talk to each other. The phone number here is area code 831-427-3772. Again, area 831-427-3772. 427-3772. I was attracted to the title of this next item. It says here, testimony of a, quote, progressive Orthodox Jew. And then I opened it up, and it turns out to be essentially another, quite frankly, request for donations to Jewish Voice for Peace. It is for Jewish Voice for Peace, isn't it? Yes. But I'll read the basic thing to you so we can all appreciate what this person is talking about. Charles Manekin, Director of Jewish Studies and Professor of Philosophy, the University of Maryland. I'm making a gift to Jewish Voice for Peace this holiday season in honor of my hero, Judah Magnus. And here's why. Magnus was an American Reform rabbi and founding president of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. But even more importantly, he preached the ideal of coexistence built on equality and self-determination for both Palestinians and Jews. In bold letters here, this next sentence is, the only Jewish organization I know that fully embodies those ideals today, justice, equality, and freedom for both peoples, is Jewish Voice for Peace, and that is why I am proud to be a member. Skipping a few pieces here, I want this to be just notes to ponder upon and not just another bequest for money. I am occasionally asked, how did an Orthodox Jew and an American Israeli like me end up in Jewish Voice for Peace? The answer is simple. I was raised by my parents with solid humanist values. In fact, my family's Judaism was inconceivable without those values. It never would have occurred to me that a commitment to justice could clash with a commitment to Jewish peoplehood. But then I moved to Israel, again in bold type, and I saw that clash constantly. In the treatment of women in the religious court system, this, of course, refers to Israel's essentially Jewish court system, in the religious court system, in the treatment of non-Orthodox religious denominations, but above all in the treatment of the Palestinian people, whether living under occupation or as citizens excluded from Jewish nation state, or as refugees from their Palestinian homeland. So, he goes on to say here, I wanted to believe that Israel had the inner strength to deal with its problems on its own. So I supported liberal Zionist parties. Bold letters here. It took the breakdown of the Oslo Accords and the brutal suppression of the Second Intifada to convince me that what was needed was a genuine partnership between Jewish, Israelis, and Palestinians and a willingness to think outside the tribal box. At the age of 54, I started a blog, The Magnus Zionist, that's M-A-G-N-E-S, Magnus Zionist, in which I began to publicize updated versions of Rabbi Magnus's views and testimonies. I found an organization that I felt was devoted to putting Magnus's views about full equality into practice, updated to meet present challenges, and that organization was Jewish Voice for Peace. Whether waging... He uses italics here. Whether waging historic corporate accountability campaigns, fighting for free speech on campuses, or standing strong with Muslim or Christian allies under attack, JVP activists are always there, always loud, always standing up for what is right. The pressing demands of my job and my blog doesn't allow me to spend much time on activism. But I donate my money to Jewish Voice for Peace because they provide me with that clear Jewish voice. Israel slash Palestine is now my home, but it is also the home of millions of others. Roughly 10 million. And that's inside Israel alone. I believe the Palestinian population of the territories is about 3 million. The people who live there are not enemies, but rather potential allies in dispelling the darkness of chauvinism, bigotry, and excessive tribalism. I hope that others will be inspired to donate to the most significant Jewish group fighting for progressive values in Israel and Palestine, Jewish Voice for Peace. Thank you for providing me with a home, and may we continue to grow and go from strength to strength. Happy holidays, Charles Mannequin. Director of Jewish Studies and Professor of Philosophy at the University of Maryland. If you want to find out more about JVP, their contact info is info@jewishvoiceforpeace.org. info@jewishvoiceforpeace.org. You can also go to jvp.org to get onto their website. Okay, and it is now 4:31 in the afternoon, this Monday, December 22, about a 25, 24 minutes left program here, and listened to some really beautiful music a moment ago. Let's see what I've got up here. Yeah, seems like I'm always making excuses about why I don't have a tighter program, why I don't have this stuff prepared so the access is easier and easier for me to read and all that. Well, now the famous holidays are upon us, the proverbial annual big holidays, Jewish holidays. Roughly the time of Islamic holidays and certainly Christian holidays. I did grow up as a Christian, so I do tend to think in terms of Christmas, as Christmas time. Family stuff and other matters make it continuously difficult for me to put more time into show prep. But I'm trying really hard. Okay, now there's a bunch of... along the lines of what I just read to you, I've just pulled this out of my briefcase, a couple of pieces of paper stapled together. I did it, so can you. In the same vein of the piece I just read to you by Charles Manneken about Rabbi Magnus, I did it, so can you. This is what I know. Each of us has the power to change, and when we do, the world changes too. I know this because I changed. My name is Rebecca Subar, and I'm on the board, and I am the board chair of Jewish Voice for Peace. It's a role that would have seemed ridiculous 30 years ago when I was living as a settler in Gaza. I grew up in a warm, strictly observant Jewish family in Western New York. When I was 8, we first visited my cousins in a farm village north of Tel Aviv, and my senses remember it best, jasmine and singing on a truck ride to the sea. I was a teenager in the 70s, and for the most part, the hippest causes matched my family's values. They cared about racial justice, education reform, and ending war. My first political troublemaking was on behalf of Israel, trying to get my synagogue youth group in line with the new West Bank Jewish settler movement. It was the edgy, exciting way to live a political dream, and, I thought, the right thing to do. Alas, I learned it was not so simple. In 1982, I went with my own young family to live my dream of being part of the settler movement. Our lives were deeply entwined with our love for Jewish everything. The spring we were there, Ariel Sharon, then Israel's Minister of Agriculture, came to speak at the groundbreaking for the new regional yeshiva, a house of study. Jewish protesters came, leftists opposed to the new settlements. One of them approached me, to my surprise, someone I recognized, Michael, a friend from home. He asked, "Rebecca, you can't seriously be part of this injustice, can you? Do you know there are Palestinians living down the road and this is their land?" It made my head spin. How could we be doing anything unjust? Justice was something our people did. Settling our land was justice. Our community was good to our Arab neighbors. Our rabbis talked with their sheikhs. Michael's comment was so off, so wrong. But my friend had planted a seed that day. A seed that racked my head and made painful space for new information and new doubts. In a brief space of time, these doubts and my deeper down belief in equality and fairness occupied my entire awareness and prompted me to fundamentally change my life. So you could say I am living proof that people change. People have the power and responsibility to live into the change they believe in, to speak their truths in order that others, and so the world, can change too. I am part of Jewish Voice for Peace because this organization gives me the tools and courage to be the person, like my friend Michael all those years ago, who says, "You've got to live your beliefs, Rebecca." The sweet smell of jasmine still tugs at my memories. And I still sing the beautiful old songs with my family. They are an important part of my history. Just as justice is, not just for my family, my neighbors, my people, but for everyone who shares this planet. For Palestinians and Jews, equally. Thank you for reading. Thank you for donating. Thank you for singing and for joining me in honoring our mutual belief in justice for all people. Sincerely, Rebecca Subar, Board Chair, Jewish Voice for Peace 9. Is that a typo or something that spilled over from whatever I was printing this from? Anyway, again, not to push the idea strictly of donating to JVP, which, by the way, is by no means a sponsor of this program. I happen to be a paying member, annually paying member myself, even though I am not Jewish. And, of course, that's perfectly fine by them. Not just because of the money, but the organization is open to support and participation by all. But again, they do not support this program. I just cannot help but coming across a lot of pieces by the Jewish Voice for Peace group. And I wanted to read that to you again. Okay. Well, you see, I recently, I think it was either before or after I did my Saturday show reading of the JVP published book, Reframing Anti-Semitism, I did three successive programs on the nature of Zionism, the origins of Zionism, as I have come across the pieces. And there's tons of stuff from that folder that I never got around to. I've read this before, I'm quite sure, on a previous show. Let me do it again, since I mentioned liberal Zionism once or twice today on this program. This is from the Electronic Intifada, 21 December of last year, 2013. The Nightmare Hidden Within Liberal Zionism. Opinion editorial by David Lloyd. Since the American Studies Association, ASA, announced this month, this was a year ago now, that its members had voted overwhelmingly to endorse the boycott of Israeli academic institutions, the predictable outpouring of furious responses has been proliferating. They range from former Harvard President Larry Summers' recycling of the threadbare charge that the boycott is tantamount to anti-Semitism to the soundbites of homophobic, Islamophobic venom that have been spewed onto the ASA's Facebook page and into the inboxes of its officers. But surely the most disingenuous of responses to date is that of the Crisis of Zionism author and Open Zion editor Peter Beinart in the Daily Beast, despite the fact that Beinart eschews the overheated and overtly bigoted language deployed by other critics. Reference to, quote, "The real problem with the American Studies Association's boycott of Israel, 17 December 2013. Indeed, Beinart generously exonerates the ASA from anti-Semitic tendencies, though the ASC has no need of his good graces on that score. It would have been better for Beinart to consider whether the really anti-Semitic gesture is not the Zionist demand that all Jews, no matter what their political or ethical beliefs, accept a single state as their representative and offer their allegiance to it, even if it is founded in discrimination, exclusion, and ethnic cleansing. To demand such an identification of all Jews is not only to dismiss the growing number of Jews worldwide who are challenging the nature of the quote, Jewish state, but also to erase centuries of diverse and non-Zionist Jewish traditions. Beinart also gives the ASA a pass on inconsistency, both for being an academic association boycotting academic institutions and for seeming to single out Israel for special attention. The ASA doubtlessly welcomes his dispensation, even though what it really reveals is his complete misunderstanding of the history and practice of boycott as a political tactic deployed by social movements. New section in quotes, Orwellian. But it is at the very heart of his column that Beinart reveals the peculiar and irresolvable contradictions that afflict the would-be liberal Zionist and the extraordinary contortions of truly Orwellian language that are required to magic those contradictions away. How else, indeed, can one manage to normalize a state that has made itself an exception in every possible way while demanding to be viewed as, quote, the only democracy in the Middle East? Beinart accuses the ASA and the Palestinian boycott movement as a whole of covertly, and I quote, opposing the existence of a Jewish state within any borders, end quote. They refuse, he complains, to distinguish between, quote, the West Bank, where Palestinians lack citizenship, the right to vote, and the right to due process, and Israel proper, where Palestinians, although discriminated against, enjoy all three. It's a nice sleight of hand. Admitting that there is discrimination in Israel takes the reader's eye off the real game, which is to pretend that the discrimination is an aberration, not the very essence of Israel's basic laws and practices. New subheading, Shell Game. Beinart cannot know that Israeli law makes a distinction between holding formal citizenship, or Ezrahut in Hebrew, while distributing the crucial category of nationality, or le'um, on ethnic grounds, thus reserving for Jews the most substantial rights, including that of return and access to land. I'm going to read that again because it's important not only for my listeners, but for me to keep in mind when I'm evaluating all this stuff. Author Beinart, Peter Beinart, cannot know that Israeli law makes a distinction between holding formal citizenship while distributing the crucial category of nationality on ethnic grounds, thus reserving for Jews the most substantial rights, including that of return and access to land. In other words, to put it very broadly, holding citizenship within the recognized state of Israel, recognized by the world community, holding citizenship there is categorically not the same thing as being exempt from categorizing its own citizens by nationality on ethnic grounds. Maybe they'll touch upon that a little later here. Continuing now. This distinction was reaffirmed in October 2013, by Israel's High Court, which threw out a petition by 21 citizens to have their nationality recorded in the population registry as Israeli rather than Jewish. The court ruled that removing this distinction would endanger Israel's status as a, quote, Jewish state. That is to say, one where Jews are privileged above non-Jewish citizens. In this malicious shell game, Palestinians and other non-Jews face not only discrimination, but permanent exclusion from fundamental rights In this malicious shell game, Palestinians and other, quote, non-Jews face not only discrimination, but permanent exclusion from fundamental rights that in virtually every other state and any claiming to be a democracy are entailed under citizenship. New subheading, Palestinians are not, quote, immigrants. Peter Beinart also seeks to cover up another act of exclusion that is fundamental to Israel's character as a racial state. This is his most fabulously Orwellian moment. This is his most fabulously Orwellian moment. And I quote, the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement's call for respecting, protecting, and promoting the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and properties denies Israel's right to set its own immigration policy. So does the movement's call for recognizing the fundamental rights of the Arab-Palestinian citizens of Israel to full equality, which presumably denies Israel's right to maintain the preferential immigration policy that makes it a refuge for Jews. End quote. preferential immigration policy, quote-unquote, is the sanitary phrase with which Beinart describes the denial to refugees of the right, guaranteed under international law, to return to their homes. Palestinians in the diaspora who seek to return are not immigrants, but an indigenous people that has been ethnically cleansed from lands and communities where they have lived for generations. They are the people who lived in the village of Isawiya, on whose expropriated land Hebrew University has built its Rabin building, or who were deported from the destroyed village of Sheikh Mouanis, on which Tel Aviv University is located. Or they are, like the great poet Mahmoud Darwish, the, quote, present absentees, people disappeared almost as much by the richly inventive language of Israeli discrimination that Beinart echoes as by the actual practice that turned an indigenous people into, quote, immigrants or, quote, infiltrators. And that process of transfer is ongoing for the inhabitants of occupied East Jerusalem, who, having been consistently denied permits to extend their houses under Israeli, quote, law, find their homes demolished or, quote, legally expropriated by settlers. The exclusion is ongoing for any Palestinian, quote, citizen of Israel who, having married another Palestinian from a few miles away in the West Bank, is denied the right to family reunification and must self-transfer to other parts of the occupied territories. If an Israeli Arab and Israeli Palestinian marries a Palestinian who resides in the West Bank, then the Israeli Arab is, like so many of his predecessors, ethnically cleansed from Israel under Israeli law. New subheading. Rights as, quote, existential threat. I'm going to race through this because we're getting close to the end of the program. Rights as existential threat, quote unquote. Is the Palestinian demand for Israel to, quote, recognize the fundamental rights of the Arab-Palestinian citizens of Israel to full equality, end quote, so outlandish or outrageous? In what other state would such a demand by any minority, indigenous or not, be seen as heralding the destruction of the state or as discriminating against the majority? The examples that come to mind, inevitably, are apartheid South Africa or Northern Ireland in the days when it was a, quote, Protestant state for a Protestant people. And Catholics, who forged a civil rights movement to demand equal rights, were confronted with brutal state rejection and violence. Such regimes, based fundamentally in discrimination or in the grossly unequal exercise of power or privilege, always regard any challenge to the system that maintains equality as an existential threat. The truth of Israel. In this respect, the occupied Palestinian territories are not to be distinguished from the, quote, normal or, quote, proper state of Israel. It is not only that, as Gideon Levy recently wrote in Haaretz a year ago, all Israeli institutions are complicit in the occupation. It is that the occupation and its practices are the truth of Israel itself. The early Zionists, in their recognition of the existence of an indigenous Arab population that would not accept colonization, and in their belief in the necessity of an, quote, iron wall of military force to realize their colonial projects, were not only prophetic, they were considerably more honest than current liberal Zionists about the nature of what they are doing. New subheading, quote, two-state solution threatens Palestinians. The increasingly remote possibility of the two-state solution, undermined by the daily expansion of illegal settlements, will not resolve the essentially discriminatory nature of an exclusive racial state. Perceived as a, quote, demographic threat, another Orwellian euphemism invoked to justify ethnic cleansing, it is Palestinians in Israel who face an existential threat in any two-state solution. Such a, quote, solution would not and should not put an end to the Palestinian pursuit of justice and equality. Under what dystopian code would any people abandon its rights or its pursuit of equal treatment under the law? But does this mean that the BDS movement intends the, quote, destruction of the State of Israel, with all the connotations of genocide or expulsion that that phrase more or less openly invokes? It seeks its transformation. Final subheading here, an invitation. The BDS movement demands what Israel actually pretends to be, a normal democracy in the state of all its people. It does not ask anyone to leave or to accept less than equal rights. It does not ask anyone to leave the state or to accept less than equal rights. It asks only that Jews be willing to live on equal terms with non-Jews, with Palestinians or Bedouins, Christian, Muslim, or secular, and to live in a land of all its people. That would be real belonging, not colonial settlement. That is an invitation, not a threat. It is an invitation to Jews everywhere and to all people to realize the emancipatory potential embedded in every struggle for justice and in every act of local or international solidarity with those struggles. It is an invitation to free oneself from the painful contradiction of advocating democracy and defending and supporting oppression. It is an invitation to step out of the meshes of a Zionist dream that has become a nightmare, ever more rigid and repressive, and to embrace the possibilities that the risks that true democracy and ethical decolonization entail. Nelson Mandela's death has brought to mind again the fact that for a peace process in South Africa to begin, white South Africans had, to their eventual credit, to stand down from their exclusionary racial privileges. In Northern Ireland, too, Protestants had to relinquish their monopoly on rule in order for the peace process to begin. Some have called these costs of peacemaking. Some have called these the costs of peacemaking. Perhaps it would be better to think of them as the gifts peace brings to those willing to contemplate cohabitation in a just society. David Lloyd is Distinguished Professor of English at the University of California, Riverside. David Lloyd, on the December 21, 2013 issue of the Electronic Intifada. Thank you for joining me. I'll be back next Monday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, as ever. Join me this Saturday for that edition of Mideast Migraines, where I will finish Chapter 5 and most likely begin the Chapter 6 of Freedom Sailors. You can get in touch with me at MideastMigraines@gmx.com. Check that. That is not the name of the website. That sounds more like the name of this program. And I don't mean website. The email address for this program is MideastMadness@gmx.com. Again, the email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. Thank you. Ta-ta for now.